Hello, and welcome to The Abstract. Here is where we talk to people about the ideas that we all should be thinking a little bit more about. And today, we are chatting with Bob Chipman, film critic for Geek.com. A.K.A. Movie Bob, he's known for his insightful and incisive film reviews, as well as a number of deep dive analyses of pop culture and film. He does great work, and I'm particularly a fan of his series examining the problem with Apu, both the movie and the reality, and I'm also a fan of his definitive deconstruction of all the things wrong with Batman v Superman, and if you saw that movie, that's, you know, a lot. So, we got a longer intro today, though, because I do need to mention a few quick things before we get started. This is a pretty long chat I have here with Bob on today's show. We got into a whole lot of different nerdy tangents, and going forward, we probably won't have episodes that are nearly this long. But Bob brought so much to the table this time in terms of pop culture opinions that I felt we should keep editing to a minimum. Also, we do our best here to release the show in a timely fashion, but it's all one big fun learning experience for us, and sometimes things fall short. So our conversation today with Bob is a bit dated in parts. We talk about some movies that came out a while back, Star Wars, superhero movies. At one point I mentioned that I hadn't seen Solo, A Star Wars Story, or Avengers Infinity War. I since have seen both. Solo was kind of middling. I don't know. It was all right. And then Infinity War's pretty cool. My inner child liked it. Hashtag Thanos did nothing wrong. Last note. One other real-time teachable moment and lesson learned that's captured at the beginning of our conversation with Bob is don't presume to bestow any titles or job descriptions on someone who you're interviewing without running it by them first. I start off in fine fashion by making this mistake with Bob, and I apologize for stepping in it real good. So let's go hear me do that, as well as the rest of our great conversation with Bob Chipman here on The Abstract. Bob Chipman, welcome to The Abstract. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, wonderful. So you are a YouTuber. You review movies for Geek.com. You are an online presence and generating lots of wisdom about pop culture, from video games to film to TV and everything in between. It's 2018 as we're recording this. Being on YouTube, doing all that, how are you finding that now? What's the environment like out there?
Cringing at being referred to as a YouTuber.
Okay.
is part of how the environment is. And I don't mean that as a, any sort of, like correcting you for that. I understand, you know, is that your material show is on YouTube. It's how you're referred to. I did not set out to be part of the YouTube economy.
Okay, I know, I understand. I may as well have just called you a tween. I'm sorry, but
no. It's okay. No, it's not an age thing. It's not like a. It's like as to a, you asked how it's going. It's going, in the sense that I'm on YouTube. Is how it's going.
And, I see where you're going with that. Yeah.
YouTube is a. All at once, a remarkable tool for people who would otherwise not have their voices out there to get out there and to produce never before seen or heard from content and to reach people and to completely reshape the cultural conversation. And it is also at the same time a cultural garbage fire that is possibly responsible for the complete collapse of discourse and human civilization as we know it. It is what it is.
I can't disagree with you there. I understand. Yeah. I mean, well, in terms of the garbage fire, kind of everything is a garbage fire right now. And it's almost a question of, like, what's the alternative? You know, I mean, is TV all that better? Is radio all that better?
I mean, I can't get on TV right now, so I would, like, for me, no. I think that the wonderful thing about YouTube and the early internet is that anyone can get on and have a show. And the terrible thing about it is anyone can get on and have a show. And, it is as it is. And, The reason that I tend to cringe out at being described as a YouTuber is both on both ends. I don't really engage with, like, my stuff is on YouTube because it's the only place to put it right now.
Right. No, of course. Yeah.
Like, I work in the medium of video because, That is where the money is at with what I do. And, you know, like I write an article and I try to shop it around. And, you know, maybe after contacting 20, you know, sources, I can make a certain amount of money selling it to, you know, get put up on a bunch of websites, you know, for a couple hours, or I can record my voice and turn it into a video essay and put it up on YouTube and keep a Patreon running that, actually pays to keep a roof over my head. Yeah. And that's a no-brainer, from where I'm at. But like I'm 37 years old. So I am among, when I say that I don't think of myself as a YouTuber, on the downside, people, when they think of YouTubers, they think of two things. Like there's the positive thing where they think of someone like Lindsay Ellis, someone like, Jonathan McIntosh, someone like Anita Sarkeesian, someone like, even though they worked on, Vimeo, like, Every Frame a Painting, people who are, you know, really set out to work in video essay format and use that, and they optimize and they engage with that audience, and they follow the algorithm, and they work around to that audience and are really there to maximize it. And what most of those folks have in common is they are about 10 to 15 years younger than I am. And they came up in a film studies, media studies landscape where this was just something that you learned going through. I did not. When I was still in film school, you were still learning about film. Like actual strips of film. He says making the strip of film editing gesture with his hands as though you can see me right now, which you cannot.
Yeah, okay. So it's really changed that much in that period of time.
It's night and day. The idea that part of my living involves social media, do you know what Social Blade is?
I haven't heard of that. No, tell me.
Neither have I. I have no idea what it is, but apparently it is an absolutely vital part of how your ratings and status on YouTube is measured. I don't know what my status is on it. I don't care to know. But apparently it's a thing and you're supposed to follow. I don't know. I don't know any of it. I don't really know how the Google algorithm counts my ad revenue or whatnot. I know that ads run on the videos and some of them do better than others and I get a certain amount of ad rev for that. But like this is all a mystery to me. None of this was covered because it didn't exist when I was learning how to do it. Twitter wasn't there. Facebook was a thing that my younger sister did in college that I did in high school that I didn't pay attention to because I was a grown up. When I was going to finally work on like real websites, when I was going to get jobs with The Escapist and Screw Attack to get things up there, and they were saying, do you have a page on Facebook? Do you have stuff up on your wall? Do you have likes and favorites? My reaction at the time, which I'm embarrassed of because it's, you know, like gendered and ageist and whatnot, was, no, I don't use Facebook. I'm not a 14-year-old girl. And now, you know, Facebook is your life stream. You know, you just can't use other applications and stuff. So all of this is, you know, now my understanding is you go into media studies, you go into film school. Part of it is just you learn about trends and algorithms and keeping your social score up and your Q rating. This was not part of my life. So I am engaged in the YouTube economy to the degree of that is where videos go and that's where I put them. So I don't feel that I deserve to be thought of as a YouTube creator like people who actually maximize it and use it and know how it works. And by the same token, I don't want to be thought of as the other thing people think of when they think of YouTube, which is the, you know, the Logan Paul, PewDiePie, sub Sacha Baron Cohen, jackass, P people who just go out with a GoPro and shout racist things into a camera, and somehow that is monetizable. So, like, I don't deserve to be thought of as the good kind of YouTube, and I don't want to be thought of as the other kind of YouTube. I'm an old man for, you know, the period, who is putting stuff on YouTube because that is where video goes. And that is why I put it there. And if there was some other place to put them, I would, as I did when I was on The Escapist. They had, when The Escapist was a thing, and when Screw Attack was, its own thing, they had native players, and I put stuff on their sites. So I'll work in any format that, anyone wants to pay me to work in. If someone wants, to pay me to do a show on, you know, a cable channel, network television, film, I'll do it. I'll go and do community theater. I have done community theater. I started on cable access television. I started on cable act. That is how much of an analog old man I am in this business. I literally started on cable access television.
Well, that's kind of awesome. I mean, to my ears, anyways. I mean, What you just kind of said was a pretty good summation of the barren landscape, or the hellscape, I guess, that we now exist in with social media. I think we quickly tipped into the dystopian form of that several years ago, and it's, we've just been living it since. So, again, you know, a YouTuber is a loaded term. I think I know that now. So apologies for that.
Well, I'm sensitive about exactly like two things, and that happens to be one of them right now. But that's not on you. That's on me.
But boy, am I off to a great start. Okay.
No, it's good, man. It's all good.
Okay, so let's rewind a bit there. So you went to film school. Can we talk about that, or where'd you go?
Well, I was in the film program at Salem State College.
Okay.
Which is now called UMass Salem. So when people ask, technically, I went to UMass. It was not a UMass at the time. It was a state. It was for all intents and purposes was trying to become a UMass. I was there when they were still building the extra buildings necessary to house the number of students that would become a UMass. So when people ask, I went to UMass.
Okay.
So,
and going into it at the time, and do you recall what are some of the either the films or just the concepts that were driving you to be a film major and go to film school? Just what were the central things that you were kind of, you know, looking to emulate and looking to bring forth?
I wanted to make a whole lot of money and not hate what I had to do to make it.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. So that was pretty much where it was. Like, I really wish that there was either a more noble or a more interesting origin story to this. Like, I really wish that I had something to struggle against. Or I wish that I don't wish I had something to trouble, you know, just for purposes of sounding less like an entitled douchebag, I really wish that my origin story was not being a mostly comfortable upper lower middle class white kid from the suburb the lower tier suburbs of Boston. Who really liked, you know, nerdy horror movies and idolized people who had made schlocky B movies with their friends in their own hometowns, like Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson and whatnot, and really dreamed of doing that kind of thing and getting big off of it and going into the film industry and becoming a big shot. Off of it, but that is, I mean, obviously I, you know, studied serious film. I follow film history. I got into it. I have an abiding love of, you know, real cinema and, you know, serious things and my own interests and whatnot. But what drove me into actually pursuing it as a career path was, you know, studying it, trying it out, getting reasonably decent at the tools of it, and, just kind of wanting that.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think we all kind of want to say that we have a hero's journey or whatnot, but, you know, we're all just human, too. Sure. So in terms of, you know, what you're doing, I think that's pretty clear that there's, you know, you're bringing a lot of insight to the films you're doing, particularly the one that sticks with me. I think you've done some great videos on the DC universe, just kind of picking apart what happened there. And it's not exactly, you know, we've that ground has been well covered, I know. The one I come back to, though, is when you were talking the Fixing the DC Universe video where you talk about the Flash and how that, you know, the Flashpoint video, which we're all, or sorry, the Flashpoint film upcoming, which we're all kind of waiting with bated breath to see if they can call an audible.
Which is now not even a thing, I guess?
Well, yeah, so I was looking this up and trying to figure out, is that a thing? What's the latest from that you're hearing?
Supposedly they're not doing it, I guess.
Oh boy,
I'm throwing my hands up at this point. I really am on the which, by the way, is fine because like in that video, the very first piece of advice that I opened with before doing, you know, I think that was like a 15 or 20 minute video, or it might have even been in two parts of the. How to fix the DCEU and, you know, what to have a plan. The first piece of advice was don't have a plan. Just make good movies, keep going and figure out how you're going to fit stupid continuity bullshit together later if you want to. That almost looks like what they're going to do. And, you know, mazel. Great. Go for it. I wish that like more than, I think there's two movies that they're making that look kind of good. Like Wonder Woman 2 will probably be good because it's just everyone from the first one and that was pretty good. So this will probably also be pretty good.
Right. That has to happen.
Yeah. And, so far Shazam looks pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen it and I haven't heard any horror stories yet. So I guess.
I feel like it's really hard to fuck that up, but they might find a way, but it seems like they're kind of doing the obvious thing with it, which is just to make a family movie. So, okay, good.
Yeah, I guess so. You know,
like that has always seemed like, and I know the reason they never did was because there's all legal stuff around that, but just the premise of that whole thing where it's like, hey, yeah, it's a little kid and he says a magic word and then he's Superman, but he's still a little kid. Wouldn't that be funny? That seems like something they should have made like seven times now. You know, like that.
Yeah, well, I think superhero movies went in a very different direction, certainly in the DC universe. You know, maybe Marvel is kind of taking the optimism and running with it right now. But yeah, putting that kind of thing and inserting that into the DC narrative right now, I mean, it's what they should be doing. But they're probably encountering a little bit of, just roadblocks from having gone in the other direction for so long.
Yeah,
why they did that. I understand they wanted to be the dark ones. They wanted to be the edgy ones. And there is demand for that. And I don't even have a problem with the fact that they chose that, but I feel like it was all about execution. And they, in my opinion, they did not execute properly.
Yeah, they did a bad job. Like, I don't want... if I sound, like, frustrated and bored by the topic, it's not because you are frustrated and boring. It's because this comes up so often. It's something that is, like, talked about constantly in the business that I'm in right now, and the answers behind it are so incredibly simple and easy. You know, it's like
exactly
it's treated like this hugely complicated question of, you know, what it's like when the Han Solo movie, the Star Wars movie comes out and it doesn't make a huge amount of money that they thought it might. And everyone goes, oh my God, what the hell happened? How is this not there? This must be this huge all ripple effects and fans. And I'm thinking, no, you made a Han Solo movie and Harrison Ford's not in it. So no one cares. That's not hard to figure out. No one cares about Han Solo other than the fact that he's Harrison Ford. Like, that's not hard to figure out. But
And you know, the reason I guess we ended up talking about it again was because I thought that the concept for Flashpoint was pretty great. And
thank you.
Yeah, no, I encourage people to check it out. I mean, basically what you're arguing for is making it fun, making it more of a romp, because first of all, that's what it needs. Second of all, that's what the Flash as a character can bring. You know, the Flash is fun, the Flash is fast, there's a lot of opportunities for humor there and just, you know, trying something new. And then you throw in the multiverse possibilities of, you know, him traversing through different zones. I don't know, I think you nailed it with that video. That's all that I was trying to say.
No, oh, thank you, I appreciate that. Like, I don't necessarily think that, like, the audience really cares about... A thing that I keep returning to is that the Marvel Cinematic Universe continuity thing has kind of, like, worked as a marketing device for Disney in terms of, like, getting people... Like, tricking people into thinking that, like, the Infinity Stone thing matters... That, like, you, like, conning the, getting mainstream audiences to buy into the same con that comic book audiences have bought into for years, which is, in order to follow, you know, what happens next is gonna be so complicated that you absolutely need to watch everything that happens in between, even if you're not really interested in it, has worked so well as a marketing thing for Disney that the fans who have maybe not taken the step back that I think healthy fandoms take and recognize that even though it can be fun to let yourself get carried away with marketing, you're still being carried away by marketing.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. But I think they're doing it quite well. You know,
Marvel's doing great at it. They're doing great at it because they're not letting that override the movie.
Right. And they're putting the old Disney shine on it, and they're making it fun. They're making it so you actually kind of don't have to see all the movies. You can kind of pop in at any point, really, and, you know, go along with it.
It doesn't actually matter.
No, it doesn't. It shouldn't.
Where the dumb magic space rocks come from, you know, in Infinity War doesn't matter. And to the degree that it does matter, they tell you again at the beginning of that movie. You know, and just in case you didn't bother to watch all of our other little movies before this, this is what this is and this is what it does. You know, in a minute and a half now, everyone's caught up. Let's just go. But if you're, you know, a big fan of this, it gets in your head and you think, oh, yes, big epic story. I need to remember to buy all these back issues and read them and watch them and absorb this into an identity that consumes my life and surround myself with merchandise. Yes. And that works great. The problem is when that becomes the narrative, and that's what happened to comics comics have been kind of arrested there for like 15 years because the comic book store economy collapsed in on itself with Diamond. And now the only people still buying regular books are, you know, people who actually have mistaken continuity porn for good storytelling. So you wind up with stuff like Batman v Superman, which does not so much have a narrative as it has giant setups for things that might pay off later and callbacks and references and stuff just mashed together and all this ominous crap nonsense. And it's the opposite of what the Disney Marvel thing does, where they've looked at it as we're going to make movies, we're going to kind of allude to other things going on, and if it lines up, it does, and if it doesn't line up, we're not going to bring it. The Marvel movies are full of continuity loose threads that have never been picked up, never gone anywhere again, things that contradict each other. In the first Iron Man, they act like there's never been a superhero before or that no one's heard of them. You know, Nick Fury says to Tony Stark, he goes, do you think you're the only superhero, huh? And then like two movies later, we find out, well, no, there's no way he would think that because his father knew a superhero who was so famous the world was making newsreel footage about him. And also there was and then like six movies later, no, there was a tiny guy that also everyone knew about that was fairly famous. And this has been going on for a while. There's a running joke in the first Iron Man that clearly implies that S.H.I.E.L.D. is a brand new thing that hasn't figured out what its acronym means yet, but then by the very next movie, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s been around forever, since World War II, possibly before that. The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. changes how old Hydra is every season, and every time they move on to the next movie and they need to fit this into the continuity, they just do what the comics do, which is go, what? What do you mean? No one's looking at that. Whatever.
Because
no one cares.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in my perspective, that's totally fine. It's kind of garbage or junk, but like fun junk, but it's fine.
Yeah.
And it's sort of an interesting quandary because I think those are much more watchable movies. It's a much more engaging universe, but it's kind of made for the layman. Whereas the DC stuff, it's sort of an interesting paradox where I appreciate that one of these large properties tried to like do the serious thing and, you know, really at least put on the face of caring about all those, the minutiae and the Byzantine continuity threads and all that crap. I appreciate someone tried. And I think it's a tragedy that they didn't succeed because it's not like Marvel's doing that. I think that's kind of absent from any of the, really anything in Hollywood right now. I don't know if you agree with that, but I think that's kind of the larger tragedy I see as far as the failure of the DC universe.
I think that a certain level of, you know, treating the, I think that if a property that demanded that it be treated with that level of seriousness was, you know, up there and they didn't take it, that would be a real shame. I don't know that Batman versus Superman against a space ogre guest starring Wonder Woman and introducing the Flash, Cyborg, and Aquaman is that movie. But, I don't know. Maybe it could be. I don't know that any of the stuff that Marvel has been doing so far demands to be that. But, in general, I don't know that the superhero genre the straightforward version thereof lends itself to that kind of Sturm und Drang very easily, unless you're using it to make, like Watchmen is using it to make a point. Watchmen's point being, don't do this. This is bad. Don't ever do this. But, or The Dark Knight Returns, which is doing a political thing, or, you know, The Incredibles sort of to an extent is doing a, you know, it's a family friendly version, but it has kind of, the first one has kind of a semi serious take with people, you know, characters are dying and there's, you know, the government is banning things and whatnot is, has a thing to say about family and individuality and whatnot. I think, for example, Black Panther is a lot less funny than the other Marvel movies overall.
Definitely. Yeah.
Mostly because once it gets to what it's about, it sort of recognizes this is stuff you can't joke about. You know, like once we're into, you know, we can do some jokes, like, you know, yeah, he kicks the thing and he flies back across the lab. Okay, this is a brother and a sister, they're joking around, but once we're, you know, talking about, you know, poverty and colonialism in Africa or a bad guy whose origin story involves being a military mercenary killer and being, growing up, you know, as an orphaned black youth in Oakland, California in the 90s. That's not funny. And they kind of cut it off. So it's not as over the top operatic dark as Batman v Superman. But, you know, everything from the staging to like the death to his, you know, I'm not spoiling the end of Black. I'm assuming you've seen the movie because you didn't.
Off. I've seen Black Panther. I've not seen Infinity War, and I haven't seen Solo. But I think I've seen pretty much all the other pop culture crap going on there right now.
Okay, that's good to know. I probably should have asked that up front. But like, so you know, like Killmonger's everything like of his exit from that movie is exactly as dark as anything in Batman v Superman. It just works a lot better because the writing is better. I mean,
he
does stab himself in the chest and die in a sunset talking about slavery.
Yeah, I would say it's darker.
As dark as you get.
I think it's darker than Batman v Superman because Batman v Superman is melodramatic and over the top, and I can't take it seriously. You know, it to me the execution it fumbles completely. It's like, you know, it's like some almost like an emo sort of situation where it's it's so over the top and so like, can't you see my pain?
Yeah.
Is that a line from the movie? Like, it's just, it's so awfully in your face about it that there's no subtlety and it doesn't work. I think what you're saying, though, is that in single servings, if you have a singular vision, you can make these superhero stories work and be serious. But then when you bring in the whole franchise, you know, and the trappings thereof, it's inevitably going to have to get lighter and more pointless, like Marvel, or it's going to trip itself up and get itself, you know, by its shoelaces and fall on its face.
Yeah, like, well, I think Marvel already tripped up a little bit to an extent with not a complete failure, but like Age of Ultron, not as good as the first Avengers.
True. And that was a little laurel resting there, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, oh, and I think part of the, well, I mean, there's a few problems with that one. Part of an issue there is it tries to be very serious at points. And if there is a, I don't know that it's completely impossible, but like a running lesson from like the history of superhero comics in general is that if you're going to do very, very like serious material, you know, like if you're going to do, okay, let's do a storyline where, one of your characters is having angst about infertility. Just a little thing about from Age of Ultron, for example. Not something you can't do. I don't know if you do it in the big, jokey, everyone, let's have fun team-up move. I don't know that you... that tends to leave a bad taste in people's mouths. You know, like, that's not a thing you do in Secret Wars. That's a thing you do in, like, the Black Widow solo book.
Right, or, yeah. And or, I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like that... kind of those plot points in that film like just washed over and nobody really remembered them because, you know, there was enough candy coated action to attract your attention elsewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas in, you know, I don't know, in Batman v Superman, just they wouldn't, it was just like a lot of mommy issues, really.
Yeah. quite a few of those. Yes. it's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, and you know, okay, so I'm a dad. I've got two boys. One is six, and he, about a year ago, totally was into Batman. Like, all of a sudden, just, like, came out of the shell one day and was like, I'm all about Batman. I understand that. And it kind of put me in a weird position, though, because he wants to know all this stuff. He wants to know the stories. He wants to know the mythology behind Batman, and that's cool. But with the last, I had to, like, you know, in ways that he totally doesn't understand at all, I'm like, well, okay, there are different Batman movies, and there were different actors who played Batman, and some are good, some are bad. I have my opinions, other people have other opinions, but, you know, trying to navigate this and you know, as a pop culture, or just a straight-up cultural thing now that is, for better or worse, being passed down from generation to generation, it's a very strange situation to have to parse this stuff, which is all just, you know, fluff and entertainment, really, but means a lot to them, and then be like, well, okay, you know, the current Batman movies are not so good. By default, now I guess I'm a DC universe. I'm in that camp because that my kids are into the heroes themselves, but they're going to grow up, and I'm going to have to the whole time I'm going to be in the shadows, scratching my head, being like, well, this story isn't that good. I'd rather you watch the Michael Keaton one, you know, and that sort of thing.
There's so much more of it now too. In the end, you can't predict or control what each successive generation is going to do with stories and properties and myths and whatnot. You can try to, and you can try to get a certain amount of control over them. You know, there are a thousand and one people who, you know, were inspired to get into the, you know, like the space program by original Star Trek. You know, original Star Trek is, I adore original Star Trek, ride or die. Hugely problematic vision of the projection of power into travel and whatnot. It's, you know, it's a fascinating, it's a, like, progressive show of its time. It's, you know, a, it's the Kennedy era benevolent version of U.S. imperialism in space.
Well, yeah, and then you've got a couple little set pieces like that apocryphal story about William Shatner, kissing Uhura. Do I have that right? I'm probably going to get this wrong. You know what I'm talking about? Where he was, he insisted on having it on camera.
Yes, yeah, that was a big deal. These things go through and change. You know, at the time, you know, in the early 1960s, right up to, you know, I grew up, you know, as a you know, I'm six to 10 year old kid watching original Star Trek, and the universal pitch made to me by, you know, adult science fiction fans and writers was that, you know, original Star Trek, you know, was a, this was the bold progressive vision of the future, was, you know, a, you know, the, what was the, you know, the benevolent U.S. imperialism in space, because that was, you know, the Kennedy era, you know, version of the projection of U.S. power as, you know, it was as good as you were going to get. And then they did Star Trek The Next Generation, which is, you know, the model UN in space is still, you know, at the time, like, we still joke about, you know, how much of a, you know, like a left of center, fantasy world is Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, where it's about, you know, the benevolent power of democracy. And you go and you watch Star Trek The Next Generation, and so much of the bold, you know, progressive vision of, you know, Jean-Luc Picard's power as the captain of the Enterprise bringing peace and bureaucracy to the galaxy is, you know, you will be peaceful or else. You know,
well, the majority, yeah. You know, whether it's on the bridge or like in the populations they were visiting, you could always rely on the majority to do the right thing in the Next Generation, you know, and there was a little bit of a Saturday morning cartoon aspect where it was always like, oh, that one guy who like wants to do, you know, the cutthroat thing, well, he's the bad one. And, you know, it's just a matter of getting it, you know, exposing his evil plan, and then everybody will, you know, come around to the right way of doing it. That's a remarkable oversimplification of every action Star Trek plot, but there was always that underlying optimism, which, looking back on it now, was a bit optimistic.
It is a bit optimistic. It's the enlightened, educated Western people will show up in the boat and teach you all how to be better version of, you know, the spread of democracy or whatever. And the Next Generation is exactly progressive enough to also have them say, but you know, we used to suck too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
that's about as good as, that's about as forward as it gets. And now, like 20 years later, that looks a little bit of a problem. So it's always a cycle. And, you know, you try to keep it going forward. You know, at one point in my life, I was someone who, you know, could uncritically look at James Bond movies and say, oh yeah, James Bond, that's how to be a man. You wear a suit and you drink martinis and you get good at gambling. And, you know, now I go back and I watch James Bond movies. I love James Bond movies. Action, drama, adventure. I appreciate the escapism and what it was trying to be about a fantasy of a still relevant British power fantasy in a post-war world. James Bond is a psychopathic rapist with a, you know, card from the Queen that says he gets to do whatever he wants and it's okay because he's fighting the communists.
Yeah, and it's fun. Yeah, therefore, you don't really notice it. I have a feeling that franchise is not long for this world, or if it's going to be rebooted, it's going to be very different.
Well, I think they're doing another one.
I'm sure they're doing another one, and they'll do another one after that. But, you know, as far as James Bond is a cultural figure, as a character, as an individual, I don't know what you can say about that right now. It's like, you know, his positive qualities, I think that we can all agree on at this point, are basically he dressed well and could order food well. Everything else is a little controversial, you know.
I don't know what they do with it other than like retroactively setting them in the 60s and just, you know, doing like Mad Men but with guns.
Yeah, and then you're basically
I don't
doing
know what else you do.
Yeah, and then you're basically I don't know. Then it's not James Bond, it's something else. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say what where the future really goes with any major entertainment property. Everything, you know, this stuff is fraught, and you know, it's just to bring it back to what you're doing. I appreciate that you're on the light side here, where you are looking at this critically, realistically, and looking for positive ways forward here. I feel like this conversation at least is hinting at that.
You have now any movie, television show, project, whatever, that so much as glances in the direction of having anything to say about some vaguely progressive policy position, even if it's something as simple as rape, bad thing, or black people exist, things of that, racism, thing that happens. You have people reacting like the people who are furious at the Force, at the Last Jedi, for any number of reasons that they claim to be.
That one in particular is a real hard sore spot for me. Not just because Star Wars is probably like the number one of all these nostalgic fantasy properties for me, but because I really did not actually like the Last Jedi that much. But for none of the reasons that people are talking about, I disliked it for reasons of film execution and storytelling rather than all those awful bullshit reasons that, you know, are permeating the internet. And I can't talk about that. Or I can't find solace in a nice online article to agree with me, because it's just talking about the wrong arguments and either debunking them or making them. And it's like, we can't even talk about that as a film. I feel like that's an interesting thing. I believe you were a fan of that one. Is that, am I right?
I am. I think it's genuinely good. I came out of it really high on it.
Okay.
I think it has flaws. I think a lot of them do. I don't think they're especially large flaws, but I think it does a lot of things really, really well. It has what I would call some structure issues. I think they're largely born of trying to do really interesting misdirection stuff with the structure, but I think that they are structure issues. I think Force Awakens had a few more structure issues, but I always have structure problems with. I have structure problems with almost all current blockbuster movies. It feels like no one knows how to do an act structure anymore.
Force Awakens had those issues. I think Last Jedi, depending on what you're talking about, I think it got much worse in that regard. However, I would say Last Jedi had a lot more fun moments. Like I liked the bomber run in the beginning with that. I liked Mark Hamill. I did not like what Harrison Ford was doing in Force Awakens. I liked everything that Mark Hamill was doing in The Last Jedi, and I like Kylo Ren as a character, but there were thematic problems, I think, with The Last Jedi. Basically, I thought that in a nutshell, it was a movie that presented a certain number of interesting philosophical and conceptual questions about loss, about the meaning of war, about change, and then by the end of the film had almost in a way that it felt like it was like laughing in my face, just throwing those ideas out and say like, oh no, nothing changes, war's fine, and it doesn't matter that all those people died. You know, so that's where I kind of had an issue with it.
No, I can see that. It's not where I am, but I get it. But I liked overall where it was going. I think I like it as a character piece.
Yeah, which character are we talking about here?
Well, I think in general, I like it as a carry. The back and forth with Rey and Kylo Ren, I think, works really well. They didn't do what I thought that they were going to do, which I was really glad of, because it seemed so obvious from the previous movie and from the marketing. I thought, oh, please don't.
Oh, what's that? Get them together and have them do the deed?
No. I think that's still possible, but I hope not. No, I thought from the way that they were going with the others and how much J.J. Abrams likes it and the setup, you know, likes to, you know, do the flip around things. I really thought that where they were going was that the person who's supposed to be good and the person who's supposed to be bad were on the wrong side.
Yeah, that could be.
I really thought that was, it doesn't seem to be where they are now.
Right. No, it doesn't. But you know what frustrates me is it seems like where they are now is where they were at the end of Force Awakens. And what I was intrigued by for the first half of the movie, because I agree that the dynamic was cool, and you know the mind melding stuff worked for me. Kylo Ren basically gave the whole like ultimatum, the sort of like third way anarchist sort of like join me and let's not be on the light side or the dark side, but let's like do our own like freaky thing, and I thought that would be what they do, and that would be cool, but then it was just like, no, 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 we're just going to go back to, like, you know, Rebels and Empire, light side, dark side. Yeah. It just felt like a big reset. Like, they set all these chess pieces on the board, move them around, and then just reset them. So, yeah.
I can see that. I'm not sure that he was so much... I know he says he's talking about a third way. It doesn't seem like... It seems like his concept of the a third way in that is, and this, if so, this is kind of like true to the sort of character he's written as, is it seems like what he thinks of as a third way other than the dark side is just the dark side, but he's in charge of it.
Right. Yeah. Cause he's an immature character, which is one thing I like about him. He doesn't like get it. But I guess I would have, long story short, I would have liked to see Rey partially give in to this whole temptation to the dark side, other side that was obviously telegraphed as going to be part of this movie. And it was just a little plain and disappointing to me for it to be like, she's tempted, what's going to happen? And it's like, the obvious thing is, well, she doesn't give in to the temptation. That's what you would do in, you know, 1980. And, well, that's just what they did this time. And it's like, okay, well, that was the default story choice, it felt like.
Well, it's also deliberately reversing Return of the Jedi, which that whole thing is that they're, that like they, the entire, they basically fast forwarded to the end, that since the whole thing is that the entire first two movies now are a series of replays and reversals of the big moments from the previous trilogy. So that whole business with the Snoke and when they got there, I was like, Oh, okay, all right, so we're already at the end of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, you're on Death Star 2. Snoke's going to die. It was obvious.
So we're going to do this now, and so they did that whole thing again. It's like, okay, all right, so now the Emperor's dead, and now we're going to do this. And I kind of liked the messing with the audience thing of giving him, of like having this huge big moment where, you know, because so much of the audience was invested in the idea of, oh, these two, they have so much, the actors have clear chemistry, the characters have chemistry, you know, and they're doing like this back-to-back fighting thing, they're throwing the lightsabers back and forth, they do a like literal back-to-back fighting, they're killing all of these other red guys, they kill the bad guy. It might be the best lightsaber battle in the entire series. Might be.
I wouldn't disagree with that. That was the most, like, as a set piece, it kicked ass, yeah.
Like, it looks like the big setup for not only, you know, oh, wow, they are like the perfect, you know, fighting team. This is, and not uncoincidentally, a call back to like EU stuff where the two kids are fighting together and yeah, all right, cool. This is where we're going. It's, you know, Rey and Ren are the battling couple thing and we're going to do this. And then it gets toward the end of it and she gives him the easy out of, okay, you killed the bad guy. Okay. All right. Cool. Just like Luke turned Vader, she's turned him. But this time, you know, new Vader actually gets to come over and be, oh, wow, we get good guy Vader fighting on the good guy side. How cool is this going to be? And the little shit still doesn't fucking get it. And I sat there in the theater and I clapped and I was like, oh, you son of a bitch. Oh, that hurts. That hurts. And I like it. But I get not liking it.
Yeah. I just didn't have that perspective on it. To me, he was never going good. For me, and this is to Adam Driver's credit as an actor, I think he did such a good job in both films of establishing himself as a little shit and just being like this incorrigible, immature person who's in charge of some sort of space empire and has no business doing it. I don't think he ever broke that mold. So for me, it was always like, he's always going to like do his crazy thing. And it was, the question to me was whether Ray, who I think is well acted, but by Daisy Ridley, but is not, is a moderately interesting character who I think, it's not like her. Okay. So like they kind of threw out the whole, like her origin story in this movie. And that was supposed to be, you know, I don't know, like a big anti twist, I guess. To me, that meant nothing. It was just like, okay, so that's just like not on the table anymore. Okay, so what is interesting about her other than the fact that she is now basically just a Jedi fighter person who's like got a good heart? It didn't develop her very well, and I thought it would have been so much more interesting if she had at least, if not like signed on with Kylo Ren, at least maybe gone rogue or just done something other than what she did, which was the, you know, if you're playing a video game, just like choosing all the light side, all the positive good guy choices, you know?
I can see, I mean, she's rogue to a certain extent because she does not take Luke's advice.
That's true. I think, well, then you get into the whole issue of whether Luke's advice, I also thought that Luke's advice or Luke's philosophy in the film was convoluted. I think that it made sense that he was like, you know, basically Yoda, out on a abandoned or distant planet, being grumpy, not wanting to train someone. I think that his whole philosophy about what to do about the Jedi and what Rey should do, I guess it was realistically wishy-washy, but I just found it wishy-washy in a way that was unsatisfying.
I get it. I'm not there, but I get that. I get the reaction of, a lot of this is gonna be like payoff dependent.
Exactly.
Like,
yes.
I like where it ended up because it's, you know, like thematically, I like the misdirections and like to where it ended up. I like the, you know, it's when they ended on the kid with the broom, I'm like, okay, all right, that's, I get what you're saying. I get where you're going. This is, I get the angle here. This is where we're doing away with the noble bloodline business here. And we're going in another direction. I get it.
I get that too. Yeah. I guess maybe I was coming at it with like just a different set of values, a different set of Star Wars values. To me, the noble bloodline stuff was never quite like that important. To me, I guess I was more about, this is maybe just like me being like a political nerd, but I was always about like the balance of power stuff. To me, between the light, the dark, the Empire, the rebels, that was always interesting to me. And what was disappointing was that I felt like the movie ended exactly where it began. To me, it feels like if you could remove this movie from the canon, and with the exception of Luke being gone now, I feel like not much has changed from where Force Awakens left off. I feel like they tried to set up a lot of interesting concepts. Okay, so the other concept, I guess, is that the futility of war, and which was very clearly hammered with Benicio del Toro's character, the arms dealing stuff. I thought that was interesting. It was the first time Star Wars is talking about the fact that, like, hey, there's shades of gray on both sides. The rebels are not always good. You know, one man's freedom fighters, another one's terrorist, yada, yada. But then to end with the broom boy, to me, I had a very different reaction to that. To me, it was almost a betrayal of that the entire film of like, that kid is a radicalized terrorist kid in the making, if you look at it one way. And it, to me, totally throws out the concept of shades of gray and war, where it's like the ending is played with like positive music or a positive message about, yes, we will keep fighting. Yes, the message will go on. Yes, we will continue to do what our older brothers and sisters did in this fight, which if you rewind to the beginning of the movie with Leia talking about like the need to be realistic about losses and then later, you know, all the arms dealing stuff and don't pick sides and all that, to me at best it was a mixed message. Sometimes I feel like it was almost like deliberate trolling. It feels like.
I do think there is a deliberate messing with the audience in there, which is I think it's in different places than that. But I do think there is some of that. What intrigues me about the next one is that unlike the previous third movie where they went into where the the end of The Empire Strikes Back is, the title is quite literally, you know, the Empire is in the strongest place that it's been. It's, you know, the power is consolidated. This is, you know, like they are really large and in charge. In this one, like the bad guys have, you know, kind of they're in a really strong position because we've, you know, revealed that the good guy side is in complete disarray. But to the degree that the First Order has any kind of like real like power and organization, no one is driving this ship anymore. You know, the two people seemingly in charge of this whole thing are Kylo Ren, who is emotionally compromised, to put it mildly, and Hux, who seems to be a genuine psychopath and completely incompetent, and is telegraphing being the much worse villain of the third movie since the first movie. But that's a whole,
and Snoke, who is almost like non-functional as a leader. He's just like, is technically, well, I think you're right there. And that is very interesting. And I did pick that up. I just think that the movie should have drilled down harder on that and kind of maybe made that a little more clear in terms of showing maybe how it played out among the regular people, as opposed to having to intuit it based upon the characterization of the leads, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you make the Star Wars movies have always been unusual in that they're scored and shot and thought of as epics, but usually they're character pieces about relationships between about five or six people. And, Last Jedi basically kind of sets itself down and says, okay, this is basically a movie, you know, maximal about, Rey and Kylo Ren, and minimal also about Rey and Luke, and also about Poe and the Resistance, and also a side story about Finn and Rose also. But like our main thing is this back and forth between Rey and Ren that seems to be going one way and then goes another way, which I do think that when I say deliberate trolling, I think him not turning is their big act of trolling, because it really did, everything from the casting to everything else felt to me when he first showed up like, for lack of a better word, it looked like they were setting him up as Edward Cullen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see that. Yeah.
That he has to turn good because he's tortured and cute. Or at least I'm told he's cute. I don't know. I'm,
well, I guess
fundamentally heterosexual, but
he's got an interesting face. He's striking. I don't know. I kind of get it, because he has presence. I wouldn't say he's like imposing, but like he seems like that kind of guy who would command a room if I were in it with him. You know, I don't know.
I mean, he just kind of looks like an in shape Dave Grohl to me, but okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see. I think what you're saying about the third one, a lot of setup for payoff, is a lot's riding on that. And I wish that weren't the case, but I guess we'll see when we get there. And for better or for worse, this The Last Jedi is a movie that inspires a lot of opinions. It inspires a lot of fruitful discussion, and it's just a damn tragedy that so much of that discussion is, I think, just in utter gutter bullshit.
Well, and so much of it's stupid bullshit too. Like, if the stuff that's just garden variety racism and sexism, I can like dismiss out of hand. Or like the guys who are just, you know, like, oh, I hate Rose. She's a terrible character. Oh, okay, why? Like, explain what's going on. And they can't do it. And then eventually it drills down and it's just like, oh, you just don't find Kelly Marie Tran particularly attractive?
Okay. Yeah, that's probably what it was. And I think that was actually a great choice that they didn't introduce another, like, you know, sexualized female character.
They added one other woman into Star Wars who's not a, you know, small-framed English brunette. Oh, no.
Right.
You know, perish of that. I, you know, like, and this is the thing, is that this shouldn't even be the discussion. I happen to think Kelly Marie Tran is a lovely woman. But, that doesn't matter. You know, I like the fact that there's a, you know, a differently shaped, you know, Asian woman in coveralls is the, you know, one of the heroes of a Star Wars movie. Fine. That's fun.
Yeah.
Let's,
And she, like, I liked her character in concept. I don't. I think that I also have dialogue issues with both the last two movies. That we just say dialogue issues. I don't. I think it's a lot of hokey crap in many cases, and I think she got some bad dialogue. But you know, as on paper, yeah, I'm in favor of Rose.
Yeah, I'm right there, and it's frustrating. I wish that. This is like one of those monkey's paw things because I shouldn't wish for this because I'm going to get it, you know, but I wish I had better enemies. You know, I really do because I should probably be grateful that, you know, I am mostly argued with and, hated and assailed by just a constant unending stream of easily defeated morons. It is really tiresome.
I think we're part of a generation that's going to feel old before our time if we don't already.
Oh Jesus, I already do.
Yeah, it's there's a lot to take in and a lot of bullshit to wade through. And
we're talking about nostalgia right now. We're talking about nostalgia. My father, I remember my father being 40 before the music and things that he liked and listened to were referred to as classic rock. My father had to have three children, you know, have had a job and built a life before he got to be nostalgic about being an 18-year-old. Buying nostalgia stuff when they were 22. I'm 37 and I am looking around thinking things like, oh wow, I guess the 80s nostalgia wave has moved over into the 90s nostalgia. The 80s nostalgia wave should be starting now when my gray hairs have started to come in, and instead it started 15 years ago. That's obscene.
Well, what do you see that as a function of? Do you think, on the one hand, it could be like cultural backlog. There's just so much stuff that it gets clogged up and it, you know, like it overflows out of the sink. But then, of course, there's the argument that we are all so desperate for those fleeting good years that we had at this, and we're old before our time again.
That's it. It's, you know, it's old before our time, information moving too fast, information moving too fast, you know, people being told to grow up too quickly. Also, I think that, our generation in particular has probably, a lot of us have, been in the workforce, have been kind of, you know, are being encouraged to kind of hit the, this is as far as you're gonna get. So, you know, start building the this is the foundation, so start filling your house up with the stuff that makes you feel good part of your life earlier than our parents' generations were.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So there's a whole lot of reasons that this is going on, and none of them are good. And I can only imagine, I follow, just because of the business that I'm in where I'm older than most of my contemporaries, I follow a lot of younger people on, like social media and whatnot. That sounds so creepy. We named everything on the internet and didn't think about what it sounds like. I follow young people on social media. I have people in my timeline who are younger than me on social media, and I see things getting tweeted into my timeline that are like nostalgia callback things to, like television shows and whatnot for like 10 years ago that I didn't even know happened. I recognized that there was something societally wrong with the idea that my parents' generation wanted to be 18 forever and my generation wanted to be 8 forever. And I don't know why, I don't know what's going to happen to like a generation that's 20 now. You know, what are they just going to wish that they never had to get past 6? You know, where, I don't know where that ends. This is depressing. I'm sorry, but the end point of that is the third act of WALL-E. You don't want the third act of WALL-E. Ironically, like the healthiest thing, like the reason that you don't see outside of the comic book store world, which is just at this point kind of a lost cause, unfortunately, that you don't see the same level of toxicity swirling around the Marvel stuff that you do around the DC stuff, and that you're kind of seeing what I hope is the last gasp of with the Star Wars stuff, is that the Disney thing, and I have enormous problems with Disney and their ongoing attempt to absorb and control the planet Earth. But culturally, they are really, really good at making things immortal by, like, disinfecting them. And as a side effect of that, the kind of toxicity that builds up in a bad fandom is really hard to remain attached to something that is in a Florida theme park sitting next to princess cakes. And I think that, to a certain extent, when the Star Wars, the angry toxic nerd culture thing looks at it and says, you know, the Disneyfication of Star Wars is, you know, destroying traditional Star Wars fandom. God, I hope they're right.
Thanks to Bob Chipman for joining us today on The Abstract. Let's keep this outro short. You can support Bob on Patreon at patreon.com/moviebob1. And of course, you can find his movie reviews on geek.com and YouTube. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you next time.